brilliant, volatile, passionate, incisive, clinically insane. That's Dr. Archimedes Wolf, the unforgettable protagonist of Go Figure, which returns for a second season on Masterpiece Mystery. I'm Alan Cumming. Tonight, we welcome back perhaps the brainiest detective in all our glorious pantheon, Archimedes Wolf, a mathematician who solves all her cases by boiling them down to their raw numbers. Now we present Go Figure, Season 2, Episode X, when X is the set of all positive integers that are not perfect squares, and there are two distinct integers in A whose sum is 104.
But who could have killed my husband? Everybody loved him.
Somebody didn't, Lady Doppler-Kepler, and that somebody killed him.
But who?
Any ideas, Dr. Wolf?
It's obvious who did it, right? Doesn't everybody see?
No, not really.
Okay, try to stay with me here. Let f of xy be a continuous, real-valued function on the plane of xy. Suppose that for every rectangle r of area 1, the double integral of xy over r equals 0. Must f of xy be identically 0? So I define the two variable functions like this. That inside function, where s value is fixed and integrated with respect to t, so its second-order partials turn out to be continuous. Usually, in calculus 3, this function's used to make the connection between Fubini's theorem and Clairaut's theorem. I put xy equals 5 here. Do you see? Now, 2 times 3 equals 7, so if we differentiate this function in a different order, we still get double integral 0, which means your husband was killed by a left-handed, lactose-intolerant Croatian woman with a drinking problem and two Dalmatian puppies, one of whom is allergic to bee stings.
Excuse me, did you say 2 times 3 equals 7?
Of course.
2 times 3 equals 6.
Maybe in some other base system?
No! 2 times 3 equals 6.
You're absolutely certain?
Yes.
Okay, I may have to rework this equation a little. So now we've got an open disk D with a radius of delta. If T is a number between 0 and delta, then function value at this point...
This may take a while. Tune in next week for Go Figure, Season 2, Episode 2, If T is a number larger than 1.
And now I think of this guy as 9 lines that cut a square into 2 quadrilaterals whose areas are in the proportion 2 to 3. In McEnroe, I kill myself sometimes.
All right, this is indeed a show about mathematics. It's going to be at times a show about competitive mathematics, but it's also going to be a show about people who do mathematics at a very high level and why they do it and why it seems so difficult for the rest of us. I mean, let me put it a different way. Usually, if you ask a physicist or a research biologist to explain his or her research, that person can kind of dumb it down enough to you so that you can sort of understand more or less what they're doing. With mathematics, it's really difficult, I think. And those of us who – it should be a universal language, but in some ways it's the language that so many of us don't speak. So we're going to talk about why that is and maybe what could be done about it. But first, our producer, Josh Nalea, went out into the streets to find out how people think and feel about math.
I'm wondering, how do you feel about math?
How do I feel about math? I'm glad it's there. I'm glad somebody else figured it out.
It is horrible.
Why is that?
Not the best at numbers. I don't know, it just doesn't appeal to me.
Math is exciting. We need it every day. And I would just advise every child to stay in school. It will help you through life.
When I hear of math, I say, that's why I went to law school, so I wouldn't have to do math, because I can't do math to save my life.
I think math is important. I don't know if they're doing better right now because of the computers and all the children are online and they're learning more, or they just need basic sitting in their seats in class and learning how to do math.
Are you good at math personally?
Not really. I'm fine until we get those equations. If a train leaves Chicago at 8 o'clock and the train leaves, my kids always tease me about that because I always joke.
All right, word problems. All right, let me tell you who's on the show today. In the studio with me is Xiao Wu, a pre-med student at Yale University and the 2013 and therefore most recent recipient of the Elizabeth Lowell Putnam Prize for the top female performer in the prestigious Putnam Mathematics Competition. We'll tell you all about what that competition is and what it means to have won it. Also with us, Mark Saul, the 1984 winner of the Presidential Awards for Excellence in Mathematics and Science Teaching, as well as the Mathematics Associations of America Director of Competitions. He spent over 35 years teaching and promoting the advancement of mathematics across the world. And also with us, Dr. Keith Devlin. Now, he's the math guy on NPR's Weekend Edition. He's many other things besides, the author of 32 books, including, I believe, at least one book about actually really solving crimes using mathematics. But author of 32 books, including The Millennium Problems, the seven greatest unsolved mathematical problems of our time, five of which Xiao Wu will eventually solve. Because you get $5 million. You get $1 million every time you solve one, right?
Yeah.
All right. So let's get to work, all right? And we'd love to take your phone calls as we go along here, but let us kind of set up a framework here right from the beginning. Dr. Keith Devlin, I'm going to start with you. You know, you may have been able to hear the tape that we were playing of People Out on the Street. It's a song that you've heard sung many, many times before.
Right.
And you know, one of the things that I've read on your blog, Devlin's Angle, I actually linked to a video by another mathematician called Against Answer Getting. And I wonder if some of that avoidance and some of that fear and loathing that you hear in that tape is the result of people who grew up in a culture in which mathematics and answer getting were pretty much the same thing.
Absolutely. Imagine if you had never heard music being played, but you had to spend the first 6 or 7 years at school learning how to read and write musical notation and play musical scales. I don't think many people would enjoy music. And it's the same with mathematics. We show them the nuts and bolts and the details of how to do it, but we don't show them the beauty and the challenge and the fun of actually doing it. That's the problem. The people on the streets, except the one who said it was exciting, have never experienced what mathematics is. They've been stuck at the ground level of learning the basics, the nuts and bolts. You know, Van Gogh would not have become a painter if all he had to do all his life was paint fences. Painting fences is boring, but boy, if you can paint like Van Gogh, that's really cool.
Xiao, I think you said something similar to Josh as you were getting ready for this show, that for you, mathematics isn't about getting answers. It's about learning to think a certain way.
Yeah, like how you approach the problems, how you interpret the problems in another way, and how you can solve it in with total different solutions.
So, and Keith Devlin, I know in one interview you talked about a moment when you were 15, 16, 17, where you had sort of a breakthrough or maybe even a math epiphany, epiphany, I don't know, there must be some word for it, and you described it as almost like climbing up above a forest canopy and being able to see the world kind of spread out before you in a different way. Maybe you could say a little bit more about that. I mean, I think it's an inaccessible idea for most of us that you could see the whole of it and it would be beautiful.
Yeah, well, you know, I went to high school in the UK. At the time, space exploration was beginning. The Russians had put up Sputnik, and Kennedy said we were going to get a man on the moon. So there was a great excitement, if you were a young teenage boy, a young pre-teenager in those days, in my case, of getting into the space age. And so I wanted to go to university and become a physicist, to do physics and then maybe go into engineering or to do space science. That seemed really cool. In order to become a physicist, I knew, and my teachers told me, you're going to have to learn to be good at mathematics, because I wasn't that great at mathematics back then because I wasn't interested. I found it pretty boring and tedious. But I had a motivation to learn mathematics in order to become a physicist to get into the space exploration business. But then when I got to 16, I realized that all of these, what used to seem to me separate, dull techniques for solving problems, they all were just manifestations or little pimples on the edge of this glorious world of mathematical thinking that Xiao just mentioned too. So it's this wonderful idea of being able to think a certain way and to see things that are otherwise invisible. I often say that mathematics is a way of making the invisible visible. Things, hidden structures become visible through this way of thinking called mathematics. And once everything fell into place, it really was like a jigsaw puzzle falling into place. And suddenly I realized it wasn't a collection of isolated, dull, uninspiring techniques. It was this wonderful way of thinking, and those particular techniques I'd been taught were just little pinpricks on the edges of this, the beauty was hidden beneath it. It was like the tops of little islands that show up above the ocean, and all you can see is a tiny bit of rock. But you put on a scuba diving and you go underneath, and you see those are not little isolated bits of rock. There's a beautiful world beneath the surface of the ocean. And as a mathematician, you swim in that world, and you see the beauty, you see the coral, you see all of the creatures, and the poor suckers still on the outside up above the water just see those little bits of rocks, and it looks boring. Down underneath in that sea of mathematics, you see the beauty. And it was about 16 when I saw that. And the moment I did, I lost all interest in going into space research. I became a research mathematician.
All right, so let's add Mark Saul to this conversation. Let's add you, too, if you're out there listening. Our number is 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. So, Mark Saul, let me tell you a sad story that kind of connects to what Keith and Xiao have been talking about. So when I was a student, a freshman at Yale University, where Xiao is a pre-med student now, I was assigned, you are assigned randomly to a faculty advisor. And you have to meet with this person once, I think, per semester. This person does have to kind of sign your statement of courses that you're going to take. And so I was assigned to a man named Abraham Robinson, who was a mathematician. Now, I was exactly a product of what Keith Devlin just described. I saw math as a dull, uninspiring, disjointed network of not even a network, disjointed bunch of techniques for solving problems that I wasn't interested in solving, and I didn't think I was any good at them anyway. So I really did not look forward to my sessions with Abraham Robinson, and I don't think he looked forward to his sessions with me either, because I was trying to get out of math as much as I possibly could. And so the short version of this story is I later realized this man, as you probably know, was one of the giants of his generation. He was the inventor of something called non-standard analysis, which is a way of looking at infinitesimals. He also had this amazing story about just having escaped from Nazis. I mean, this man really would have been a fabulous person to get to know. And at the level that Keith Devlin just described, he was probably a person who could communicate some of the beauty and the integrity of math to me. But I had already become this really prejudiced, crabbed, hard-shelled person. And I guess this is something that you deal with all the time. How do you prevent, and there's also a fundamental paradox, too, which is I couldn't understand Abraham Robinson unless I did learn some of these techniques, right?
Yeah, so you're asking the question which occurred to me as I was listening to Xiao and Keith, which is, how do you get there from here?
Right. How do you get that scuba equipment that Keith wants us to have?
Okay, so let me tell you, as long as everybody's telling their own story, I'll tell my story. I was a total nerd. I was totally different from what you're talking about. I loved math because I loved the nitty-gritty and the techniques, and I was good at it, and I could solve the equations the way the teacher wanted to, up until ninth grade. And then I was set a very good teacher, and she was giving us what was then an advanced topic, arithmetic progressions. And I was sitting next to a friend of mine, who's still a friend of mine, and he was brilliant. And so the teacher gave us these formulas for arithmetic progressions. I said, well, wonderful, they're great formulas. And then she gave us a little problem. Insert three arithmetic, you'll find out what this means if you don't know in a minute, but insert three arithmetic means between 3 and 16. So I started doing it, and I had this formula. I had to plug into another formula, and it was like untying a knot. I loved it. I said to my friend David, well, let's do it. Come on, let's do it together. He said, oh, I did it already. It's 3, 7, 10, 13, 16. And I looked at it, and I said, of course it is. What arithmetic means are numbers that are equally spaced. Mm-hmm. And he could just do one. He saw through it into the meaning of the formulas. And he could do the problem just by looking at it because he saw what the meaning was. I was doing the problem slogging over land. Mm-hmm. And it's that connection between the intuition, thinking is really intuition, and the expression of the intuition and the encapsulation of intuition so that it can go on to produce more thinking. That you have to communicate as a teacher. As a teacher, I want to make every problem a thinking problem, not a rote memorization problem or apply a technique problem.
You know, I want to hold on to that and come back to it. I think it'll be great to ask Xiao Wu some questions about that too when we get to what happens in a competition like the one that she's about to go into. How much intuition as opposed to brute technique she uses. But before we do that, Xiao, since everybody is telling their stories, let's hear your story. You did not grow up initially in the United States, right? And so were you exposed to a different kind of math teaching?
Yeah, I grew up in China, and I went to Singapore for high school. So back in China, math training was like a big thing for kids. So I was in there too, and the training was very stressful, and the structure was rigid. I still remember, like every Wednesday, we would get a math test in my class, and every Friday, we would get the test score back. So I call it like Gray Wednesday and Black Friday for me. And whenever I like didn't do well, my teacher would call me into his office and like scold me like why you didn't do well. So that was very stressful. And then in Singapore, the math competitions were more flexible, I would say. We had like buzz runs. So when you go on stage and you have to solve a problem within a minute. So that was kind of fun. And we also have like sabotage runs. So it makes math more fun for me. I mean, also like after coming here, I think it's no longer as stressful because I'm not going into like do a math PhD or whatever. So for me right now, competition math is just like fun, something I would do to just like to stay focused and to forget about whatever else I have to do.
Math is something that makes your problems go away. I don't think most people think about it that way. But so, Keith Devlin, listening to that.
The only time I ever miss my stop on the subway is if I'm doing math.
Well, see, that's...
The world disappears.
Well, you know, Keith Devlin, as you listen to that, I mean, here's this young woman who's, in fact, very near the top, at least of competitive math right now. And it seems as though she did some of the early work through exactly the kind of routine and grinding and stressful drilling that ought to, in fact, dampen someone's enthusiasm for math. So how do we deal with that paradox?
Yeah, and indeed, you know, I mean, I was self-motivated by wanting to go into physics, but I found it dull and boring. It wasn't a teacher that was forcing to do it. I was forcing it onto myself, but I had the same experiences as both Mark and Xiao did. In terms of competitions, I should mention that I'm completely different from Xiao. I'm so slow at solving mathematical problems that throughout my schooling, I was never regarded as that good at school until I was in the high school and self-motivated, and then I just looked fast because all of the problems I'd already done before on my own. But I'm not a fast thinker, so I actually never entered math competitions. I can't do well at them. So there are other pathways in. If you're motivated and you can do it by the fast competitions, they are wonderful. But an awful lot of people like me, they have the ability, but it takes time. And for me, I have to see the underlying beauty, that scuba diving thing I mentioned. So for me, a teacher would have to show me that beauty, show me where it leads to. In other words, teach me music appreciation before sitting me in front of the instrument. Some people you can put in front of an instrument, they'll learn to play. Some people need to appreciate music before they'll teach themselves. In my case, I would need to have been shown the beauty, the appreciation, so that I could self-motivate it to do it. But to this day, I'm slow at mathematical thinking, and so I would never do well in a competition. And nor would I do well in a classical exam. The only way I got through my university exams was by guessing in advance what most of the questions were going to be, which is usually not difficult, and making sure I had those techniques at my fingertips. So in a sense, I was just regurgitating stuff I'd already done. I got to play the game of mathematics education to be successful, and once I was through it and into a PhD, where you've got 3 years to solve problems, I got into my element.
You know, this goes back to that. This has been coming up a lot on our show and in my thinking a lot lately, is that not just in math, but in but everywhere, that our idea of examinations, I think, is for the most part wrong, and that really you've been educated in something. I guess I'm addressing this to you, Keith, that you've been educated in something, you've been taught something, you've learned something, when you can carry on a conversation about it, a meaningful, in-depth conversation about it with somebody who knows more than you do. So, you probably would have been more rewarded and less bored by your examinations if, in fact, they were oral and you actually had to go in and discuss what you knew with the person who was teaching.
Yeah, and that's really what it's like in a PhD. When you're doing your PhD, you're giving seminars regularly, your supervisor, the other students, the other professors are there. You're giving talks to them. They're questioning you all the time. It's a back and forth. The important exam you do as a PhD student is when you defend your thesis. And it's a conversation. You have to argue for what you've done and you have to answer yourself. Under those circumstances, I actually do perform fast because I'm in the moment, I'm in the flow, it's a human interaction. And then my mind is racing. But sit me in front of a piece of paper on a desk with a clock ticking down for 3 hours, and I have as much difficulty as anybody else who thinks they hate math.
All right, we're going to take a break here. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about those competitions. In the final segment, we're going to have a big meaning kind of conversation about the larger meaning of math and the applied meaning of math, too. But we're coming back. We'll talk about the kind of competitions that Zhao enters. There is a shape with four sides, so it's a square. And the one who has nine is looking fine, and its name is Nonagon. Everybody turns just in time to see the Pentagon arrive. All right, we're back. And I was just enjoying the Janelle Monáe music coming in there. All right, so we're back. We're talking about mathematics with Xiao Wu. She's a pre-med student at Yale and the most recent recipient of the Elizabeth Lowell Putnam Prize for the top female performer in the Putnam Mathematics Competition. Mark Saul is with us. He actually has spent 35 years teaching and promoting the advancement of mathematics and organizing competitions, too. And Dr. Keith Devlin is here. He's the math guy in NPR's Weekend Edition, author of 32 books, including the Millennium Problems, the 7 Greatest Unsolved Mathematical Puzzles of Our Time, asterisk. There might only be 6 at this point. But I put in the asterisk. That's not actually part of the title. Mark Saul, I'm going to begin, as we talk about these competitions, I'm going to begin with you. And just maybe you can tell us a little bit about this, the tradition of mathematical competitions. You could almost say that as long as there has been mathematics, there has been competitive mathematics, right?
Yeah. One reason is that although you can't really observe mathematics being done, it's very hard, but you can observe the result of the mathematics, and you can judge it to be correct or incorrect very quickly. You can't have a competition in oil painting in the same way, in quite the same way. But mathematics competitions are as old as Archimedes. Archimedes is the famous cattle problem. It's part of the classics of mathematics, which was posed as part of challenges he was with another mathematician, and it's come down to us. This is the hardest problem he could find. The thing that I think is important is that some of this stuff has become a real significant mathematics, not just a game. So, for example, in Renaissance Italy, universities there, the early universities, mathematicians would have contests at solving equations, solving cubic and quartic equations. And they would go from town to town, and they would have their methods, and they would demonstrate how well they could do it. This has become, over the centuries, well, what we call Galois theory, the solution of polynomial equations, which is still of incredible importance to us today. You can't get money out of an ATM machine without tapping into those methods that we use that were developed originally with that kind of thinking. And if you look at the history, there are all these wonderful stories, cloak and dagger stories about one person. Cardan went to Tartaglia and said, "I'm going to such and such a town. Just give me your solution, and I'll wow them. But I'll give it right back. I won't tell anybody." And of course, then Cardan published his solution. And it's now known as Cardan's solution, but every book says because it was developed by Tartaglia. So
And my understanding that these competitions kind of vary a little bit across cultures. Do I have it right that Russian math competitions traditionally have been different from maybe the ones that Xiao is going to be competing in here in the U.S.?
Yes. I mean, I don't want to give anybody the wrong impression. The mathematics is the same. If the answer is right here, it's right in Russia. But Russian competitions were shaped by very different historical sources. They rarely had multiple choice contests, for example. And the reason is, one reason is, they couldn't reproduce a test paper because having access to a Xerox machine or a mimeograph machine, something like that, implied the possibility of subversion. You could make your own leaflets against the government or whatever. It was severely controlled. So when you gave a test, you had to write it on the blackboard. So it was great. It ended up to be greatly to their advantage, oddly, because the tests that the contests they gave are long answer. Think of them as essay style questions. They require proof, not just a computation and then an answer. And very few of them require just a single answer, which is the more typical competition in the West. And another reason that was possible is that Russian mathematicians had this very deep old tradition of going back into the high schools and even the elementary schools and working with the educators there, with the gifted kids. So you had this supply of mathematicians who could read through student answers and grade them. I've tried to do that here. I got for 100 papers, I got maybe 3 people to help me. And it took forever. You just couldn't quite do the same thing here. It's cultural forces that shape it.
Let's hear a little bit from Xiao Wu about what she's about to go through. You've already got nerves of steel from your Singapore upbringing where, I mean, you already had to do all this stuff under a lot of pressure. So this is a little bit different. This is the Putnam Mathematics Competition. You're already number one in your category. And we can talk about that category issue a little bit later, because that's also an interesting question, too, that there's a men's and women's category. So what's going to happen? December 6th, you start all over again. What's going to happen? You walk into a room, they hand you a piece of paper?
Yeah, basically. So they will deliver the papers to each university, and the professors here would administer the tests. And there are 2 parts. In the morning, there are like 3 hours for 6 problems, and in the afternoon, it's 3 hours for another 6 problems. And the problems are ranged according in ascending difficulty. So the maximum score you get is 120, and the mean, like a median, was like between 0 and 1.
Okay, so I looked at some of these sample problems and problems that have appeared on previous years' tests. And, I mean, I had absolutely no idea what was being talked about. And I even watched a video of a guy walking me through his proof of one of the problems that was on a previous Putnam competition test. And I didn't understand. And I watched it twice, and I still don't understand anything about it. But so I can't ask you an intelligent question. But let me ask you this, going back to what I think Mark was talking about in the first segment. When you look at one of these incredibly difficult problems, these are problems meant to confound or at least challenge the most talented young mathematicians in the U.S., do you begin to solve it intuitively, like what might be the right answer to this, or how would I think through this, or do you begin applying computational and solution techniques to it right away?
I guess first thing you should realize that people designed this task to be completed in 3 hours, so that they're not like extremely difficult question that requires like 1 year to solve it. So and normally I would start by like really understanding the question and maybe apply some small numbers to play with the cases and see which is the key component, what is the key question in this problem. And then there also be like standard techniques you might apply, and you solve that basically by intuition and like small trial and error.
All right. Yeah. I'm going to come back to that in a second. But, you know, Keith Devlin, you were saying before that you wouldn't fare well under these circumstances. Yep. You might prefer to have a year to solve one of these problems.
Well, a month anyway.
But, you know, in some ways, that whole idea of competitiveness, obviously there are some drawbacks to it and there's some ways in which it might inhibit a certain amount of creative or aesthetic thinking about math. On the other hand, human beings are essentially competitive creatures. Yeah. And so you've written a book about the Millennium Problems, which is essentially a competition. It's not a head-to-head competition. They're not all sitting in the same room. But, you know, that goal and this big prize of $1 million is put out there kind of to make people compete for it, right?
Yeah, and I am certainly very competitive, and I actually like doing Putnam problems, but it just takes me hours or weeks or sometimes a month maybe before I can do them because of the way I set about doing them. But I get the same pleasure that Shao does. It just takes me an awful lot longer than she can do it in. But yeah, people, I've got a natural competitive thing, and mathematics, because there are right answers to the kinds of questions we're talking about here, you can set them up as competitions. And the Millennium Problems were designed really to just popularize mathematics. It was a mathematician from Harvard who went on and made a lot of money in the stock market but always loved mathematics. He wasn't a math major himself, but he liked mathematics. And the idea was, by attaching $1 million to each of these seven problems, it would become a big news story. This was done in the year 2000. It was a millennium issue, and that there would be sort of prime problems that mathematicians could sort of set their sights on. The same had been done at the beginning of the 20th century with a set of problems called the Hilbert problems. And for much of the early 20th century, many mathematicians, including, I think, Abraham Robinson, by the way, spent a lot of time trying to solve these Hilbert problems because they were sort of beacon problems. And a good way to make your name as a young mathematician was to solve a Hilbert problem. The Millennium Problems are meant to provide beacons as well that would regard, and the idea is that these are problems that almost certainly will take many years and maybe many people's accumulated efforts to solve. So these are the Mount Everests of mathematics. They're the landing a person on the moon, landing on a meteorite or something, or a comet. It was that kind of thing they were trying to do, big things to look up to, one small step for a man, one big giant leap for mankind sort of thing. That's what these Millennium Problems are about. So they were designed to be they were chosen as problems that have been around a long time, had a lot of depth, and almost certainly wouldn't be solved by someone working for a couple of weekends.
I was sort of teasing or joking about the fact that your book may have to be retitled in subsequent editions, but this also speaks to, I think, the temperament and mentality of great mathematicians. The Poincaré conjecture or was solved by this Russian math genius, Grigory Perelman, who not only refused the $1 million, he's, I think, also turned down a Fields Prize on another occasion, which is,
indeed,
you know.
Yeah. There's all sorts of, there's a very interesting personal story about it. I've never met him myself, but I know people who have met him, and he's a sort of a very interesting, reclusive sort of a character. But you know, it's worth mentioning that it was a long time after Perelman had produced this proof and posted it on the web before mathematicians even began to think that it might be true. I mean, they knew it there was a good chance it wouldn't be, but it was a long time before the consensus started to emerge that this was true. This was not a solution that a mathematician or a small group of mathematicians could look at in a weekend and decide whether it's right or wrong. The nature of a lot of the modern problems in mathematics, including probably almost all of the Millennium Problems, is such that when someone comes out with a problem solution, it could take weeks or months or maybe even years before the mathematical community agrees it's correct. We're in a realm of problems here that really are very, not only difficult to solve, but difficult to verify whether the proof is correct or not. The same happened when Andrew Weil solved Fermat's Last Theorem a decade or so ago. It took more than a decade, is it? Oh, yeah, two
I think
20 years ago. Yeah.
So, Mark Saul, I want to go back to the Putnam contest, the competition that Xiao will be back in starting on Saturday, December 6th, and then over a series of Saturdays. And I'm going to ask you to kind of do a translation. I don't know how easy this is going to be for you, Mark, but I want you to try to imagine one of the kinds of problems that Xiao is likely to encounter on the test papers here for this competition, and translate it into layperson's terms. In other words, is there a way to? I looked at all these problems and I really didn't know what they were questions about. Is there a way that you could sort of think of a typical kind of problem, one of the kinds of problems that may come up at this level, of the Putnam level, and tell us sort of in our own ignoramus states, what's it a question about?
Well, okay, you're putting me on the spot because I don't have the questions in front of me. But this comes back to something we were talking about before, about you mentioned having conversations with you really know a field when you can have a conversation with somebody who knows more than you. Mm. I would add to that, you really know a field if you can have a meaningful conversation with someone who knows less than you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's called teaching.
You're doing that right now.
Well, some, I don't know. Shao and Keith, you can help me. I heard something in the intro when you had the detective story.
Mm-hmm.
There was something about a double integral. If it's zero, in every rectangle must be zero. Did I hear that correctly?
Yeah, actually, I stole part. I wrote that intro, and I stole part of it from a Putnam problem.
Exactly what it sounds like. That people somebody cut up Putnam problems and wove them together. Mm. Shao, did you remember that one?
Yeah, actually, I think problems like that are pretty hard to describe. But then in Putnam, they're generally like a type of question about game strategies that might be more approachable.
Game strategies, yeah.
Yeah, so let's say we play the game,
mm-hmm.
and I move first. And then we have a row of spaces in front of us. And you know there are an odd number of spaces, and we have stones. So this was a problem from last year. So each person can place a stone on space, and then or they can take a stone from a space and put two stones to the nearest left and right empty space.
Josh, write this down.
Yeah, so this was the last problem of part two last year. Mm. I don't think anyone solved this.
Mm-hmm.
But then you just listen to this problem. It doesn't seem that hard, but no one actually solved it.
Well, and you can actually play the game, right?
Yeah, yeah, like you can play with yourself when you're doing the problem, probably.
Well, and I'm sure you did.
Yeah.
This is a classic type of problem. It's a problem because you see the goal.
Yeah.
You know, how to solve, to get a strategy for the game and so on. You know the rules, but you don't know how to get in between.
Exactly.
You have to have all three of those elements to have a problem. If you don't know what you're supposed to do, which is what Colin was describing, then it's not a problem to you. It's gibberish. If you already know what to do, it's not a problem to you. It's an exercise.
We're going to wrap up this segment. I want to leave some time for our final segment. I've got a lot of questions about how all this stuff turns up in the real world. Although Richard Feynman said about physics that physics is like sex, there are practical applications, but that's not why we do it. The same may be true
of
math.
Tell me more about how it's the same as sex.
Yeah, that may be true about of mathematics as well. So we'll get to that. But before we do that, because this did come up, and Shao, I'm sure people are interested to know. I mean, most academic competitions, I don't think there is a men's and a women's division. So why is there one in the Putnam mathematics competition?
I think this prize is recent. It's only it started in 1970s.
Mm.
I guess they would just like set this prize to encourage more female participants because it is a fact that you will see a less female participant in Putnam. I remember last year I was there were only two girls in the room taking the test,
mm-hmm.
and then in most of my math classes I might be one of the few girls in the class. So
in that competition, finishing first among women, do you know how that equates to how you would have done if the men were included?
Yeah, I think my absolute ranking is the 73rd.
Mm-hmm.
That means there are like 72 guys in front of me
mm-hmm.
did better than me. Yeah.
I want you to go in there this year and kick their asses, all right?
Okay.
I mean, Saturday, December 6th, it's on. It's on, all right?
Okay.
I want you to destroy some of those guys. All right, so we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk more about mathematics. We've got lots of interesting tweets and calls and all kinds of stuff, too.
All right, here's another one. Let P of X be a polynomial of degree n, such that P of X equals Q of X times P of X, where Q of X is a quadratic. So what's the deal with airplane food? Am I right? Oh, come on, people, work with me here. I hate it when there's a math convention in town. Today's show was produced by Josh Nalea, Betsy Kaplan, and me. Our intern is Nia Tyler. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Lady Doppler-Kepler was played by Lydia Brown. The part of Lydia Brown was played by Bill Curry. For show pages, articles, and videos of the Faith Middleton show staff making a human equilateral triangle, visit our website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, our salute to beavers. And now, back to Colin.
You knew we would do a salute to beavers sooner. But beavers are really interesting. And in fact, they are being reappraised because they may actually have a significant role to play in dealing with the effects of climate change. So the whole idea of going and blowing up one of their dams is no longer cool. Not that it ever really was. Anyway, that's tomorrow. We're talking about math today. And we have a great panel here. I wanted to sort of turn away from the competitions. And Dr. Keith Devlin, I want you to talk a little bit about I think a lot of people are listening to all this and they're thinking, well, this all sounds very isolated from the world that I live in. And it is sort of true, to go back to that Feynman joke, that there are practical applications to math, just the way there is a practical use of sex, but that's not why we do it. So I assume that people who are doing math at the level that we're talking about right now, they're not doing it so that text messaging will work better someday. But text messaging works better because somebody did math a long time ago.
Yeah, indeed. And in fact, almost everything in modern society, from Google, from the internet, from CDs, from DVDs, from the cloud, all of that depends upon very deep esoteric mathematics that mostly began by people's curiosity. Sometimes it took 3 or 4 years to find its application. Sometimes it took decades. Occasionally it took longer than that. But by and large, the people that are right at the cutting edge of mathematics, of pure mathematics, and for the first 20 years of my career, I was very much a pure mathematician, we do it purely for the love of the discipline. Absolutely, that's what drives us. But there's an awful lot of other math people who use mathematics in practical ways. And in the second half of my career, I found myself working, after I came to the United States, for the Defense Department, for the computer industry. I worked for a furniture manufacturer at one time as a consultant. I've worked for the U.S. Army as a consultant. I now have a company that makes video games, educational video games, and circling back into education. So all of this esoteric stuff finds its way back into the world, or not all of it, but almost all of it. In fact, it's been said that mathematics has an unreasonable effectiveness because we get more practical payback from mathematics than is believable when you look at the most esoteric parts of mathematics. It's hard to imagine a problem, one of the millennium problems, at least some of the millennium problems, hard to imagine them having a real application. But the way I describe it is, when we solve an advanced problem in mathematics, it's like dislodging some snow at the top of a mountain. It doesn't seem like a big deal, but at the bottom, you've got an avalanche that can change the world and can certainly change the lives of many people. Research in pure mathematics plays around at the tops of mountains, and the rest of society feels the effect when the avalanche hits the deck.
The good kind of avalanche.
No, these are great avalanches. Actually, mathematics is so powerful that, yes, it can do us great good, but it can do us great harm. Let's not forget that nuclear power came from pure mathematical ideas about exponential growth and so forth. And nuclear power has its good side, but it also brought us nuclear weapons. So mathematics is a powerful, sharp sword, but like any sharp sword, it's got two sides, a good side and a bad side. It's how we use it.
So I'm sitting next to one of the top young mathematicians in the United States. But Xiaowu, you're pre-med. So that means you don't want to be doing pure research mathematics, or you're not going to follow in Keith Devlin's footsteps. Why is that?
I find applying my knowledge in math in other areas to be more rewarding than just sitting and do pure math problems by themselves. And right now, I feel like I can use my knowledge in math to build models to do clinical research in medicine, or people are starting to use graph theory to understand human brain in the neuroscience. So I find those applications really fascinating, and I want to try it someday.
So it sounds like you're not going to be my family physician. You're going to be doing some kind of research medicine?
I can't say for sure, but I definitely want to do research in the future.
So, yeah. Mark Saul, this brings up a question, and it is the question, the implicit question in what Keith Devlin had to say, too, which is for there to be progress in human knowledge, a lot of the underlying engine of that progress is mathematics. And as Keith said, maybe it shows up in 4 years, maybe it shows up in the real world in 25 or 50 years. But it begins, so much of the fundament of it is mathematicians. It is therefore critical, I guess, that we have lots of mathematicians. Are we making mathematicians at the rate that human knowledge needs them at?
Well, I'm not sure that the rate is, I mean, if you look at it globally, the short answer is yes. There are lots of people studying mathematics. Are they getting the right mathematics? Are we getting the right people? That's a much harder question. It's a political question. And it's a cultural question. Where are these people coming from? It's a question that we have to look at just in the United States to make it very concrete. Where are the mathematicians coming from? Well, right away, more than half of them are coming from outside the United States, which is a problem because we're not growing our own. Mm. And part of it is the teaching, which everybody can trash. It's very easy. But part of it is the cultural rewards we have. Some of my best students, I'm in New York, some of my best students wave at me from BMWs that they've earned on Wall Street. because mathematics is so useful, it can be useful in that particular way. Now they do great work, and they support other people in mathematics, but we've lost them to pure math. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Well, we have to think about. In other words, the question you're asking is a bigger question than about mathematics. It's about the structure of our culture and our economics.
And the structure of our culture in terms of recognition. Xiao Wu, when you won the Elizabeth Lowell Putnam Prize in the Putnam Mathematics Competition last year, I mean, what happened? Were you an instant celebrity?
Not really. Actually, the result came out on April Fool's Day, so I thought it was a joke. So I didn't take it seriously until the next day. And I think the math department at Yale posted the results on their website, and that's pretty much it.
That was it. Yeah. Well, and you know, I mean, now you're an even bigger celebrity. You're on WNPR. But Keith Devlin, in the time that we have left, I mean, it does sort of raise that whole question of sort of who we honor and who we know about. Somebody tweeted to me during this show, talk about Alexander Grothendieck, perhaps the best mathematician ever, you know, who died last week. And it is, you know, I mean, I told the story about meeting Abraham Robinson and having no idea who he is. I mean, there is something about this field where we don't really know about the people who are really good at it, and we have trouble celebrating it the way that we would even. I mean, everybody knows who Oppenheimer, if you want to go back to nuclear power, everybody knows who that was, and they probably know three or four other names from that, too. I mean, is part of the problem we just don't know mathematicians?
Yeah, I mean, early on in my career when I was doing pure mathematics, I spent a lot of time in both Hungary and Poland. And in both those countries, the best mathematicians were celebrities. They were famous. Mm. And you know, people would recognize their faces. So it is very much a cultural thing. We've never had that history of reverence for mathematicians. I mean, a few years ago, I worked on that CBS crime series Numbers as an advisor, and I did that unpaid because I thought it was really good to have a mathematician as a hero figure in a TV series. We need to sort of elevate mathematicians in the public eye as celebrities. You know, there's a new prize, I think it's called the Breakthrough Prize, that Mark Zuckerberg and some other Silicon Valley types have created now that awards people like Terence Tao $3 million prizes for advancing mathematics. And it was a couple of days ago at NASA Ames where there was a celebration of this. So there is now at least a rising, there are signs that American culture, at least parts of it, is beginning to realize that we need to celebrate mathematicians because as a country like the United States that depends for its economic prosperity on being innovative and staying ahead of the rest of the game, if we, and this is Mark Saul's point, if we don't produce enough of our own native-born mathematicians, and I'm not native-born, I'm a naturalized citizen, but if we don't produce enough mathematicians at the very leading edge, then it's hard to sort of recognize ourselves as being able to maintain that leading position we actually need economically. So there's a real importance to being able to inspire people to get into mathematics and rise to the very tops of the discipline.
All right. I dare not ask another question because we're basically out of time. But it is it's great. It's important to tell their stories, too. And it's one of the reasons I love the play Arcadia by Tom Stoppard, because so much of it is about a very gifted young mathematician. It's clearly based on Ada Lovelace. It's, you know, even reading about Poincaré today to get ready for this show, what an interesting guy, what an interesting life. Maybe we just need to tell more stories about these people. It's been great to tell the stories of Zhao Wu, of Mark Saul, and of Dr. Keith Devlin. Thank you so much for being with us on the show today. And also a special thanks to Josh Nalea, who is sort of the newest member of our producing team. Very exciting to have him here, and this is sort of Josh's first official show of this kind. We'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for tuning in today. Fit for mathematicians and brains. 3, 1, 4, 1, 5, 9 is a ratio we don't define. 2 pi times radii gives circumference you can rely. If you square the radius times the pi, you will get the circle space. Here's my song about pi, fit for mathematicians and brains.
Dang, girl, if you was x squared, I'd be x cubed over 3 plus a constant, so I could be the area under your curves.
Oh, please. If I were Pythagorean, I wouldn't touch you with a 3-4-5 triangle at the end of a pole that was pi times x squared if x was infinite.
Oh, snap.